Mr. Boxall, reel three. As you pushed up through Germany, did you have to do much fighting with the German army?
No. By that time, when we went through Germany, there were odd skirmishes. But by that time, I think they'd the fighting part of it was actually very nearly at its end. I think the Germans were demoralised, and they were as much looking forward to it finishing as we were. And when we did an advance from the River Elbe up to Wismar, we dropped off, my platoon dropped off a couple of soldiers at various places to collect the German soldiers and prisoners of war, and they had fields full of them. As I say, I think they were glad that the thing was over. The one thing that always struck me were there were very, very few Nazis that we found. They all seemed to be Germans and they didn't support the Nazis and didn't know anything about them. And I often wondered how the Nazis managed to get going if all those that professed not to like them and not to have anything at all to do with them, and yet they were fighting for them. So.
Did you have any contact at all with the German civilians?
No. Fraternization was not allowed. We obviously went were visiting in houses, and obviously they some of the civilians were about, but we didn't have anything at all to do with them.
Did your unit take any casualties pushing through Germany?
Not that I recall. We were very fairly fortunate with brigade headquarters that we weren't right in the van of the action. I don't think any of my, well, certainly none of my section became casualties.
When you got to Wismar, what happened then?
Well, the war finished, and we were sort of resting and relaxing for a couple of days, but we weren't allowed to do that very long because on the 18th of May, we were loaded into vehicles, taken back down to Lüneburg East. A load of the coaches were flown in, we climbed aboard, and we're flying back to England.
Did you have any contact with the Russians at Wismar?
No, didn't see any of them at all.
Were there any famous names with you in brigade headquarters?
Our brigade commander was a man named Hill, Brigadier Hill, who was reputed to be at one time one of the youngest brigadiers in the British Army. And he was a well-known airborne soldier.
What was he like to work for?
A very, very good. Excellent leader. And of course our division commander was Major General Windy Gale, as he was called, Major General Gale, who then eventually became a fairly senior officer in the army.
Did you see anything of him?
Yes, saw him quite often. In fact, in Normandy, he came and sat outside of my tent and chatted to the brigadier.
What impression did Gale make on you?
Oh, he was another foreign soldier.
How did you feel when the war ended?
Well, I thought we were going to be lucky enough to perhaps have a break, but it didn't work out that way because we came home, as I said, on the 18th of May. We went on a month's leave, a fortnight's disembarkation leave and a fortnight's embarkation leave. And I walked back into the mess on the Sunday night, and the colour sergeant said to me, "Have you got your kit packed?" And I said, "No, I've just got in." He said, "Well, go down and pack it up. You're flying out to India tomorrow morning, advance party for the division going out from the Far East." Fortunately, that was postponed, and we went out by ship about 3 weeks later. But I was in India when war started, and I was back in India when war finished. I was actually in Bangalore when, or we were on a train going to Bangalore when we heard the news that the atom bombs had been dropped and the war had ended.
So you were due to fight the Japanese?
Yeah, I think we were going to do the invasion of Japan.
And so you went out with the Brigade HQ to win.
With the part of the 6th Airborne Division. To get all the training and everything all organised ready for when the division came out.
How did you feel about fighting the Japanese?
Well, fortunately, we didn't have to. I hear a lot of people now say we shouldn't have dropped the atom bombs and we shouldn't have done this and we shouldn't have done that. They weren't going to have to go and fight them. We were. And if they'd have had to drop another 10 atom bombs, I wouldn't have minded. As I say, that's all right for people nowadays to talk about it and say how disgraceful it was. They didn't have to do the job. We did. And I don't think any of us were really looking forward to it. We would have done it. We'd have had to do it. That was what we were there for. But I don't think any of us would have relished the idea of doing it. Fortunately, as I say, the war ended. And the advance party, went up into the Nilgiri Hills to do a battle course. And then we had a 7-day train journey right the way to India to Karachi, where we were stationed near the Karachi base course and used to run around the PE every morning. And then a few weeks later, we went on board a boat and went back to Palestine, where the division had been rerouted to. So, once again, out of the frying pan, into the fire, into Palestine, all the trouble was going on there.
About what date might you have arrived in Palestine?
I think that was September 45.
And where were you based there?
A place near South Bend, and then Haifa. And then finally, I was there for 2 years up to a place near the Sea of Galilee. And then that was various internal security duties. Of course, I was a sergeant when I went to Palestine. I was a colour sergeant in the company cell major. And we had various roadblocks we used to put on and curfews and all sorts of things. We had the problem very much like Northern Ireland. They were terrorists. And you had to watch out, because if they had a chance to blow you up, they did do.
How was a roadblock organised?
Well, at Haifa, we used to do a roadblock outside of Haifa on the road up to up north, and we used to put a roadblock on about 6 o'clock in the evening, and the roadblock commander had a list of vehicles and the number of personnel that were allowed in each vehicle, and you in and out of the roadblock, and anything other than those vehicles and those number of persons on that vehicle went through, otherwise they didn't. It was very strict as to the movement of the Palestinians.
So were the vehicles searched?
Yeah, buses, everything. I mean, if a bus came up to the roadblock, everybody got off, you checked them all, you checked all their identification, you checked the vehicle, you checked the driver, and then if everything was all right, you let them go on. If it wasn't, you called on the Palestine police to come and help and check out.
Did you ever find anything?
One of the posts that we used to use at Haifa, the police post that we used to use at Haifa, I believe was blown up one evening after we'd been there for a little while. But mainly it was just to make sure that they knew you were searching, they knew you were going to search, and they used to make sure that, I presume they used to make sure that they didn't come anywhere in your way so they could be caught.
And what about curfews? How were they organised?
Well, that once again, the battalion moved out. Like, if it was Tel Aviv, the battalion moved out. Curfew was put down on Chechens patrolled the streets. The civilians weren't allowed on the streets. They were off from the curfew time until the curfew was lifted. Might be a couple of 3 days we'd be on there at Tel Aviv, and once or twice we were there 2 or 3 days. And the population was restricted movement for all that time.
How did they react to having a curfew in
place? They didn't like it very much, but they had to lump it, so we had to lump doing it.
Did you get any hostility from the
people? Yes. I mean, they used to spit at you and swear at you. I mean, if you walk past and they'd open the window and spit at you and call your name under the sun. Yes, they didn't like us very much, especially the airborne forces. They didn't like us at all.
Why the airborne forces?
Well, because probably we were a bit more strict or rough or whatever you like to say than all the troops were. I mean, I believe airborne forces always have a reputation of not being exactly the best people to drive out with. But
were you stricter than the ordinary regiments?
Well, no, but I mean, we wore red berets, so we stood out, and we were the people that they sort of took it out on.
Was this the Jews or the Arabs or both?
But either side, whoever wanted it. It was mainly when we were there in 45, 46, it was mainly the Jews that were the problem.
Did you ever feel much in danger whilst you were in Palestine?
Well, yes, you were always in danger. There was always a possibility of getting blown up or shot. I mean, I've seen what they used to do. They used to put an oil gun beside the road with packed with bolts or bits of steel about an inch, a couple of inches long, with an explosion in the centre, and then they would cut past these that you detonate, and it literally tore them and cut the shreds. And I mean, there was always booby traps and things like that. You could never be sure.
Did that oil drum booby trap actually happen?
Oh yes, yeah, on Harold Carmel in Haifa, I've seen a trap that actually was bombed.
You mean the aftermath?
Yeah, saw the aftermath of it.
Were there any casualties?
Well, obviously there were. I mean, they'd gone by the time I saw the vehicle, but you could see blood stains on it and it stood on the side of the road. They were fighting for their independence, obviously. And the same with all terrorists. Eventually they get it and they become legitimate citizens. We had the same thing today with the Irish. All those are now IRA or been killing our troops and killing everybody. In 10 years' time, they will be respected citizens of Ireland and hailed as heroes. You can see it in Palestine. A lot of the higher-ups in the Palestine Liberation Army, as it was, became respected citizens. And I believe Ben-Gurion was a terrorist at one time. He then became president of Israel, I believe. And this is the same thing that happens. You can look at the Mau Mau. The same thing happened. They come out of the jungle, and eventually one of them becomes president. And I feel the same will happen in Northern Ireland eventually.
Did you have any narrow escapes yourself in Palestine?
No, not that I would have known about. We obviously went out on patrols, whether you hear gunfire and whether it's actually fired at you or not, unless someone actually gets hit, you're not quite sure. But mainly it's just the problem of having to live under the threat of a terrorist attack. And it must be exactly the same in Northern Ireland. It's the same wherever the British Army operated. Mau Mau, Cyprus, all the same sort of problem.
Was your brigade headquarters ever attacked?
No, no. Well, I was back then with the 9th Power Battalion, and we were never attacked. terrorism doesn't go on head on attacks. It's a sneak attack and go as quick as you can.
So you served in Palestine with the 9th Battalion?
Yeah, I started off with 3rd Power Brigade headquarters, but then it was found that the Defence Platoon wasn't needed quite so much, and we went back to the 9th Power Battalion. And I served with them until I came home in 47. As a result of my having been in hospital, my what they called Parsons service, which was a 3-year term of service, hadn't lapsed because my time in hospital had been counted as time still on the continent. So my 3 years started from June 44 instead of from when the battalion went out, of Palestine in 45. So when I they discovered that I was my Parsons time of 3 years had elapsed, and I was due for repatriation to England. I came home and went to the Airborne Forces Depot Order Shop.
How did you feel about your time in Palestine? Was it a happy time or a miserable time or what?
Well, once again, you're with soldiers, you're with your own ilk, and you make your own life. Once again, we didn't mix, well, I didn't mix with the population. We used to go down to the beach swimming and things like that, but and hockey played a great part of my life because I used to play for the battalion and wherever I played, the 6th Airborne Division in Palestine with hockey. I've always represented my unit. And so,
now, after Palestine, did you then, after your spell back in England, did you then go and serve in Korea?
No, I finished my service with the Parachute Regiment and went back to my parent unit, which was the Royal Orphan Regiment. And I went to the depot for a while and then was posted to the 1st Battalion, who were in Germany, in BALR, in Berlin. I went to the battalion in Berlin, took over B Company Sergeant Major, but then we moved back to Iserlohn, or not to Iserlohn, to Düsseldorf. And there I was able to have my wife and son with me in quarters. And we did the normal sort of soldier duties in BALR, training, guards, and whatever soldiers did when they went on active service.
What was it like serving in Germany in the early 50s?
It was very good because we were, as a company sergeant major, obviously we had a quarter. The food was provided by the army. We were able to have someone to look after the garden, and we were able to pay someone to look after and do things in the house for us. There was plenty of social activity, and life was quite pleasant.
Can you tell me about your posting to Korea, please?
Yes. We were in Hoverath, or Düsseldorf, and we were warned in 1951, early 51, that we were moving home. And moved home, and I think it was February 51. And moved to Dover Castle for 4 or 5 months and then on to Cromer. By that time the battalion had been warned that we were to serve a year in Korea. We had leave and in August we went on board the Orwell to go to Korea, which was a 4-week troop ship trip, which once again wasn't a cruise because there was training and rifle firing and running around the decks and keeping fit and getting everything prepared for when they went ashore at Q10.
Had troop ship conditions changed much from 1930?
Yes, they were sandy berths, and of course as a warrant officer you had a cabin, you were in a cabin rather than a troop deck was sandy berths as it was then, instead of they modernised it quite a bit.
What berths were they called?
Sandy berths, they were like bunks, you know, three tier bunks. Whereas before the war they used to be hammocks. There was no such thing as standee berths and bunks and living rooms, but senior ranks.
And what was your job with the battalion when you...
I was a company sergeant major of A Company, with Major Chapman, who was my company commander. And we arrived in Pusan. In train and went up to a camp to take over from the, I think it's the Royal Armed Rifles. We took over from them, and the next morning we, A Company were warned to move up to take over from a company on a feature called 355, which was later dubbed to be Gibraltar when the Yanks got it and built a road up it. But when we took over up there, that was a climb up from the valley, straight up the side of the hill. And we'd only not long been off the boat, I think we'd only been off the boat a couple of days, so immediately being pushed into, going up into the line was a bit of a revelation for lots of people.
Which unit did you relieve? Kings Own Scottish Borderers?
No, King's Own Scottish Borderers were,
That's what you've put here.
Oh, so was it Codfish?
Yeah.
Oh, well, it would have been the Codfish then. It was actually a company of the Codfish we relieved on 355, but the unit we actually took over from was the Royal, or we took over from the Royal Ulster Rifles.
What briefing did they give you about these positions?
Very little, because there wasn't much time for a briefing. We took over and they moved off. The one thing that sticks in my mind was the phrase that you don't have to worry much about camouflage because there's no aerial activity and they haven't got any big guns, so you'll be all right. That proved to be a fallacy when they showed the conflict about 3 or 4 weeks later. Where they got the guns from, I don't know. If they didn't have any, but they managed to plaster the hill. We could see it quite plainly. They plastered the hill with Godfrey's one. And as you probably know, the one of them won a VC private. Somebody seen something like that. But the Godfrey's won a VC. But,
can you describe the positions that you took up? What they consisted of?
Yes, well, they were slip trenches, and that was it. Some of the positions had bunkers. When we moved in, we moved we were only on 355 for a couple of days, and then we moved down to a thing called a position called Finger, which was below 355, and there we proceeded to dig in. The idea was that you had the trenches. Fighting trenches, the slip trenches down the front of the hill facing the Chinese or the North Koreans, and you had your living bunkers and that at the back of the hill. And this we did start this practice in on Finger, and then when we moved over to the San Juan Valley, we were there for the winter, so we had to really dig in and make the thing livable, because the one thing you've got to do is keep your troops warm, keep them healthy and give them somewhere fairly safe that they can be in. And you've also got to have things like a proper cookhouse, you've got to have proper toilets dug, and you've got to have all the normal things to keep the place clean and healthy and keep your troops healthy and fit. And that was part of my job as company sergeant mate.
What were the main problems that you had in your job in trying to keep them healthy and warm?
Well, obviously, you had to have fires in the bunkers. A lot of them were petrol fires, and you had to make sure they knew how to use them. What it was with a can of petrol with a rubber tube down in the bunker that went into a box with some sand in it, and a chimney made out of old ration tins or old shell cases, anything that you could use. One of the big pluses we had was if you could use a hammer and a cold chisel, you could live. Because with a hammer and cold chisel, you could make all sorts of things. You could make fires. You could make a bath unit if you wanted to. You could do all sorts of things with a hammer and cold chisel. Oil drums, shell cases, anything that was usable. The cooks had to have a safe place to live in. They had to have a safer place as possible to cook in. And you had to have a place where the people, where the troops could sit if it was wet or if it was freezing like it was in clear, where they could sit and have their meals. And these sort of things, you know, took a lot of organising. They didn't just drop out of the sky. Someone had to organise it, when you moved into position, had to make sure the cooks had a cookout to use and all the rations were brought up. Colour scientists bring the rations up. But then he was at AS level and all the actual admin of the company site was left to meet them.
Were there ever any accidents from the heating arrangements?
Once or twice bunkers caught fire, but luckily people got out before the petrol before it really went up. Mainly, people were very fairly careful. We did have on the sandwich on. We did have a village in front of us, an old village, and our company used to go down in there in the days and get collect firewood. Usually in the morning they used to test their machine guns, their brain guns and that into it, but one morning they didn't. A group went down to get some wood and there was a burst of automatic fire and away went about 20 Koreans over the paddy field over the paddy field with two of our blokes that they'd captured. But luckily the RA were doing a practice shoot in the valley and we managed to switch it over, and then whilst the shells were dropping, Corporal Ashlin, who was one of them, and Private Pantrini, who was the other one, Ashlin hit a group over the head with a rock, grabbed Pantrini and ran for it, and they got away, so they were lucky. But it taught us a lesson. Never to go and wait unless you're properly prepared.
What was Korea like as to do soldiering in?
Well, it was just a barren. In actual fact, I personally didn't see what we fought over it for. I know it was a principle of not letting the North Koreans take over, but. The actual place itself is not like it is nowadays, I believe. It was just bare hills. The villages were little huts, wooden huts, in the valleys.